Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform, where I interview military veterans about their civilian career. Today is episode number 27 with Katie Horgan.
I think that startups, both sides, employers and vets, like I think that that is a perfect match. Because if you think about what they ask you to do as a junior officer, you know, I was a truck platoon commander. You know, we went out, they literally dropped me in Iraq and were like, go run convoys. And I was like, well, okay, I got to figure this out. You know, anyone that can do that, anyone that's had those junior positions, either on the officer or enlisted side, can absolutely, you know, do what it takes to get something done and you know, quickly analyze the situation, make the best decision you can with 80% of the information or maybe less than that. And so that's why I think it's just like an incredible fit.
Top three reasons to listen to this interview are, number one, startups. Katie was one of the first 30 employees at the New York-based startup Plated, a company that has since been featured on Shark Tank, raised over $58 million in funding, and has over 100 employees. She may not be the reason for all of those things, but then again, maybe she is. She talks about the role of operations in a startup, why veterans are well-suited for it, and what it's like to be part of a company that quadruples in size while you're there. Number two, operations. Katie is now heading up operations as employee number four of the startup Crave Crush. She talks about a career in operations and why she jumped at the opportunity to build a company's operations infrastructure from the ground up. And number three, job search. Katie breaks down the hiring process for veterans in a very compelling way, talking about the common barriers veterans face when interviewing for their first, second, and third jobs out of the military. So here is my interview with one and only Katie Horgan. All right. Well, my guest today is Katie Horgan. Katie is the Senior Director of Operations at Crave Crush. It's a very interesting New York-based startup that we'll talk about in a bit. She started out at the University of Southern California, where she earned her Bachelor of Arts in Political Science, after which she served for over 6 years in the Marine Corps, first as a platoon commander, then company commander and operations officer, spending time as a convoy commander in Iraq and serving as part of a crisis response force in the Pacific Theater. When she transitioned from the military, she went to Columbia Business School, where she earned her MBA. And from business school, she went to the New York-based startup Plated, first as their director of operations and logistics, and then as their senior director of operations and logistics. So, Katie, thanks for joining me.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
I guess, first off, anything to add to that background or about your personal life?
No, I guess it's probably worth mentioning that I'm a native Californian, so I'm a fish out of water here in New York City, but
they
I think
always
you covered,
come back.
You covered most of it.
Californians always come back.
That's what I hear.
To start off, I'd love to learn about at what point you knew you were going to leave the military and how you approached that decision.
Yeah, I was in early 2011. I was getting ready for a deployment with a Marine Expeditionary Unit. I was going to leave in November of 2011, and my contract was going to be up in September of the following year. So I knew I was going to come back, you know, in June and get out in September. So probably around early 2011, I realized I better take a look at what I was doing. Otherwise, I was going to come back and then basically have 2 months to get my act together. So about a year and a half before my contract ended is when I knew I was going to get out.
Oh, man. And how did you think about the reserves and whether or not to stay in on the reserves?
You know, honestly, it was a bit of an afterthought. Like, all I knew was that I was leaving active duty. And in my experience, like, there really wasn't a whole lot of talk about the reserves. Like, the folks who are in active duty, they don't do a great job of telling you what your options are on the reserve side. So I kind of planned my exit and then didn't really look at the reserves until I got out. And at that point, I just kind of felt like I was an all-in or not-in person. And I kind of viewed the reserves as one foot in and one foot out. And I didn't think I could do that. I was either 100% in or I was out.
It may be biased by the people I end up talking to on the show, but that seems to be a common answer. Everyone's kind of full bore into whatever they're doing. And so it's kind of all or nothing.
Yeah. And I talked to some friends who did the reserve thing, both during, you know, graduate programs and also while working. And their feedback was that really like the reserve, like the drill weekends, just, it always came at a bad time. And it was just something that interfered with the next step they were trying to take, like, not to knock the people that do it, but that was the feedback I was getting.
Yeah, I can see how it would scratch the itch of having that camaraderie and still feeling like you're active in service. It was tough for me to reconcile, and even more so now. I just can't imagine It feels like my weekends are crazy enough mm-hmm. and my weeks are crazy enough. I just can't imagine being able to slot that in.
Yeah, I was in the same boat. So it just didn't work for me. I've had a couple of moments, you know, every now and then I think about it, and I have actually reached out to a couple of recruiters, and you know what? They haven't emailed me back. I've done it twice in the last 4 years. I had a moment of weakness and reached out, and I just actually wasn't able to connect to the network. So that was their loss, I guess, in my moment of weakness.
someone just got fired over
yeah.
that. When you do look back on that transition, I'm wondering if anything stands out as surprising in the transition from the military that you didn't expect at the time or didn't see coming, or just anything that stood out as unexpected in the transition?
There's a couple of things. Like first of all, I didn't really know what to expect in terms of like the support with transitioning. And I was lucky enough to have, like, I had a great XO and a great CO in my last unit that, kind of gave me a little bit more flexibility, like if I needed to go take care of something, or like I had some tests I had to take for Columbia, et cetera. So they were pretty flexible. I didn't really know what to expect, but that turned out well. But in terms of like what to do when the day actually comes and you get out, like there really wasn't any support. And I didn't think I realized how really on my own I was. I mean, there's lots of people I've connected with that have helped me afterwards, but you go from this organization where everyone's telling you, or, you know, someone's always telling you where to go and where to be and giving you a limited number of options for your next step in terms of duty station and job. And I think I didn't really anticipate what it was going to feel like when all of that was removed. And it was 100% on me to, like, you know, make the next step and choose the next direction. That probably seems kind of obvious, but the weight of that is something that you have to really experience before you're like, okay, I get this. Like, this is kind of tough. Another thing I didn't really expect was to feel the weight of like the loss of community. Like, I think you mentioned the camaraderie and how maybe the reserves can scratch that itch, but, you know, you're surrounded every day by these people who are, they're on your team, and everyone's, you know, for the most part, got your best interests in mind, and you know where you stand with the community and the people around you. And the civilian community is different. I mean, there's lots of people out there who will have your back and who will be on your team, quote unquote, but there's also lots of people that will not be. And to shift that mindset, basically, because you have to fend for yourself and realize that everyone else is fending for themselves. It's a mindset shift that took me a while to get used to. So those are two of the things I'd say surprised me.
Yeah,
took some getting used to.
Both of those resonate with me. And on that first point, I think I was surprised by that as well. And I think part of the reason why was I don't think I realized when I was in the military how defined things were and how mm-hmm. laid out for me they were. I just assumed, you know, coming straight from college, I just assumed that's the way it was. And then you mm-hmm. get used to that.
Yeah.
And then in the absence of that, it's like bumper bowling without the bumpers. You start getting a lot of gutters and you start realizing like, oh, this is not as easy as I thought. So, that mm-hmm. that sticks out with me as well. And you chose to go straight from the military into business school at Columbia. How did you weigh the thought process of going straight into industry versus going back to school?
So the first thing I did was actually look at some of the headhunters. You know, there's a lot of companies that, like Cameron Brooks, for example, that work with vets who are trying to transition and place them. And I just didn't get a sense from them that I would have as much freedom of choice and like be shown all of the possible options. Like it seemed like there was a lot more than what those kinds of companies were going to be showing me. And so I talked to a couple of other friends who were also applying to grad school, and I talked to some people who were in the programs, and long story short, it just seemed like the best way for me to give myself some time to look around while still moving forward. So it wasn't like I was taking a break per se, but I was kind of taking a break. So you get 2 years, like obviously you're at school, but you have the time to really explore your options and make an informed decision. And so I felt like that was the best chance for me to give myself the time to make the right decision without just jumping into something that some objective service or person thought it would be a good fit for me, you know?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I didn't have any direct experience with the recruiting agencies, but my sense was that's true, that it seems like very efficient, but a very limited subset of options. And I think that business school does a very effective job of, like you said, giving you that breathing room and giving you a lot of direct exposure to those other options that might be a better fit for some veterans than the ones that recruiters would present you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. And it's a luxury, really, like an expensive luxury, don't get me wrong, but like to have that time to really just interact with people and hear their stories. And a lot of the opportunities that I considered came out of informal conversations with classmates or some event I went to. You know, it's really just like organic in terms of how you find out about things that you just need time to explore. Like,
yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, totally. And what advice would you give to those thinking of applying to business school or Columbia in particular?
In general, I would say that you only have so much time to apply. And I think a lot of people, you know, they want to apply to lots of different places. But for me, I found that to really do applications well, you know, you can't really handle more than three at a time. And I talked to some people who wanted to do five, six, whatever it is, but you really have to hone in on what's most important to you and then give 100% to those two or three schools. I would also say, this is general, not just Columbia, making a connection with the vet club at the school is super important, and not doing it a couple months before you apply, doing it well in advance, because they get hundreds of inquiries from vets. Like, you know, the veteran community is and the active duty community is pretty big. So they get a lot of inquiries, and you don't want to be one of those people that, you know, a month before the application cutoff, oh, hey, I'm interested in whatever school. Well, that makes you look like you're late to the game and you're just kind of like, you know, firing in all directions. So I would say connect with the vet community as far out as possible and do an on-campus visit for the top one or two schools that you're most interested in. Like schools like Columbia have put together, you know, weekends or like a day or two where vets can actually come to the school and they could take a class and they could talk to alumni and current students, et cetera. Like those are really great events to get your foot in the door.
That's great. And looking back at your time at Columbia, what did you like most and least about your time there?
I would say what I liked the most was honestly the informal interactions. Like, I think Columbia does a really, really great job of putting together an amazing group of people. Like, I don't know where they found these people, and I'm like completely honored that they let me into this group of people. But, you know, you talk to people who have worked in Africa, they've worked in nonprofits and government and, you know, small companies, big companies, like they've done amazing things and they've learned a lot. And then you get to be in a room with these people for 2 years. And the informal interactions that I had, like outside the classroom over beers or like whatever, just the sports teams I joined, et cetera, were just so invaluable. And that was my favorite part of it. Just hearing about everything they've done and like what's possible. Like it was really inspiring to me. And also in addition to like telling me what's out there, it was just inspiring to know that there's like these amazing people out there that are basically going to be the next generation of leadership in this country. That was my favorite part.
Oh, man. Yeah,
it's a little touchy-feely, but that was my favorite part.
No, I agree wholeheartedly, yeah.
Yeah, so, and then I would say the least favorite part, honestly, was the recruiting process. And obviously, I've only been to one business school, but the way Columbia runs it, if you want to get on a traditional track for consulting or finance, for example, like, you know, the train leaves the station 3 weeks after you start school. And if you're not on the train, you're off the train. So a lot of people, myself included, feel pressure to jump on and do this formal recruiting process. And it's so structured and so organized. And to me, honestly, the process seems archaic. It's like a certain type of interview. It's a certain time frame. It's the same amount of certain type of questions that are asked. And I don't really know how you can evaluate people well in that framework, because anybody could play the game for a couple of months. But to me, that process was so it was so formal, rigid, and quick that I really didn't enjoy it. I felt like the whole thing was pretty much forced, and I didn't have enough time to really evaluate the companies that I was interviewing with. It was just so quick. So the recruiting process was stressful, and there's also a lot of pressure. Like, you know, other people around you are getting internships and jobs, and that kind of impacts how you view your opportunities. Like me, for example, I didn't get, you know, I went up for consulting the first year, and I didn't get an interview offer with the first couple companies, and it was kind of coming down to the wire. And I was like, well, what am I doing wrong? Do I have to change strategy? And it was very stressful. And I ended up taking an internship that I didn't really love because, you know, everyone else had one, and I felt felt pressure to just get something locked down. So short answer is the least thing I liked was the recruiting process, as it was stressful.
Well, you know, I was going to ask about how you went about finding your first job, but when you say that, I'm wondering if that started to inform your desire of like, hey, maybe I should go the startup route, because, you know, it sounds like you're looking at this process and realizing, man, a lot of these larger companies, the way they go about recruiting just seems fundamentally flawed and archaic. And I'm wondering if that led you to realize like, oh, maybe I would find more appealing options in a smaller company size.
Yeah, absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. So I did the recruiting for consulting, and I ended up taking a job, an internship at a small marketing-specific consulting firm for the summer. And through a combination of the recruiting process and also the internship experience, like, I just was able to completely rule out what I had thought I wanted to do, which was consulting. And the long and short of it is that I wanted ownership over what I was doing. And consulting is, I mean, not to knock anyone that does it, I mean, I have lots of friends who are doing it and learning a lot of amazing things and having a great time. But for me, I wanted to actually execute on the plans that I was putting together. And consulting was a lot of planning without being able to actually execute what we had put together. So, you know, the recruiting process in combination with my experience over the summer really just pointed me to a smaller organization, and specifically to operations, because I wanted to be like in the thick of things, making decisions that impacted the business, the bottom line, like, you know, working with people, managing people, up and down the chain, et cetera. And that just kind of became obvious after my experience with the consulting track.
You know, I'm reminded, so when you and I were emailing, setting up a time for this interview, I just really enjoyed one of your comments, and you had talked about the barriers that vets encounter when they're applying to their first or second job, and how hired managers can struggle to figure out where to fit them into the organization. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, as you think back on your own job search and job search of other veterans I'm sure you've spoken with, what advice would you give to them about that job search process and how to interview in the best way possible?
Yeah, I have like a two-part answer to that question. The first would be to like share a couple of things that I experienced in my, interviewing recruiting process. And the second would be like how I think you could be successful. So the first one, you know, I was interviewing with larger companies, specifically with the consulting firms. I felt like they looked at me as a military applicant. And so then what I was doing was really competing against other military candidates. And that's through no fault of their own. That's just, they categorized us all in one group. And then I had to do my best to stand out against that group of people. So that's something that it took me a little while to realize what was going on. And then I was like, well, gee, how do I stand out against, you know, like my peer group? Cause everyone's amazing. And so that was a little bit tough to kind of think through, how that was going to play out. And
how did you think about that? Cause I agree. And I look back, and even in applying to business school, it just felt like I might not even be applying against other military people. It might be for me applying against other submarine guys, and they're trying to find their one submarine person for the class. And so I'm wondering the thoughts you have on how do you stand out amongst people with a very similar background?
I think one of the best things you can do is just really learn how to sell yourself and pitch yourself. And that was really hard for me. Like, to your question about, you know, what was, when you transitioned, what was something that surprised you or that was hard for you? Like, what surprised me is that I didn't know how to talk about myself. Like, I'm an aggressive person. I'm confident. Like, I know how to lead people and manage people, et cetera. But you asked me to tell you about my accomplishments. And I'm like, well, no big deal. I did these things. But like, it was really my team that, you know, pulled us through, which is what I would say, because I believe it to be true. But when you're going into the civilian interviewing process, like, they need you to talk about yourself, because that's how the majority of the world communicates. They don't downplay their accomplishments. They highlight them. And so, you know, that's not necessarily going to make you sound better than another military candidate. But I think that they're looking for somebody who can clearly communicate the value that they bring to the organization. And I think the vet group as a whole has trouble talking about themselves. So if you can go in there, you know, and knock that out of the park, at the very least, you're communicating clearly. and that was, that's something I think that's tough for a lot of vets.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. I thought for a second you might say you sabotaged other veterans or, or started spreading lies about them to make yourself look better. But
no, of course not.
I completely agree. It is funny, and that's come up in other interviews as well. And I don't think I realized it until I started hearing other people say that. But I do think that, that veterans have a really tough time talking about themselves and not downplaying their accomplishments. And then, like you said, when you compare that to your average civilian applicant who is, you know, I would say, you know, from my military perspective, they are over the top in claiming responsibility for a lot of what I would attribute to a team success. When you put those two side by side, it must be really hard for a hiring manager to look at the veteran as a credible applicant, because they're just side by side with someone singing their own praises. And I do think it's very important for each veteran to find a way authentically to speak with pride about their personal accomplishments, and to not do it in a way that doesn't feel right, but be able to communicate that in a way that does speak to their incredible background and what they've accomplished.
Yeah, I mean, everyone that's served in the military has earned their experiences. You know, they've done the hard work, they put in the time, they raised their hand. Like, it's okay to talk about it. And I think it's something else we need to talk about is it's okay to talk about it. Like, we don't even talk about the fact that it's okay to talk about it. You know, I showed up at Columbia, and there's a huge vet network there. It's 50 people. You know, it's 5% of the student body. And it took us almost like 6 to 8 months to be comfortable enough with each other to like share our frustrations and the, you know, the troubles that we were having in the interview process. And just cause you don't know them, you have a certain level of trust, but you're not like, you know, sharing all the hardships you're having, cause you're also competing against these people, you know? But we eventually started talking about it. And by that point, of course, the interview process was close to over, but, you know, it should be something that comes out. Like, I think that the, specifically in the grad school network, that the second years and the upperclassmen have a responsibility to highlight that to the incoming classes and kind of start that dialogue early on, you know?
Yeah, I think that's great. And I may have cut you off midway. Was there anything else you wanted to say about just kind of the application or the hiring process or a job search process?
Yeah, I would say just again, like something else I encountered like in the applications process, not just while I was in school, but even after, like I've since changed jobs after I left Plated, you know, she did 6 years in the Marine Corps, 2 years at business school, and she's only been in the civilian workforce for 2 years. Because the people you're competing against spent those 8 years when you were in school and in the military in the civilian workforce doing specific things that those civilian hiring managers understand. And so I had trouble reconciling that because I was like, you know, I've led large teams, project management, you know, great under pressure, et cetera, and that just wasn't translating for hiring managers. And so I think there's a takeaway both for the veteran side to, you know, really think about how you can connect the dots for those hiring managers and translating your experience. Like me, for example, I learned to talk about my military experience in like a project management type light. Like, hey, I was an operations officer for a logistics battalion. What does that translate to? I was a project manager for a 300-man organization that was supporting, you know, a huge team. And then there's also a lesson for hiring managers in that, you know, especially at startups, you want to invest in someone who's going to be part of your team for the long run. And if you're a small company, that person's role is going to change 3 or 4 times in the first 24 months. So you want somebody who's adaptable, who can learn quickly, who can shift out of that role. And so being very wedded to like a specific skill set or specific experience, I don't think is going to get you the best candidate. And I think that that's tough to make that connection for a lot of people. So that's just kind of like a heads up and something I experienced. I'm still like learning how to talk through as I go along.
And I love the example, the concrete example you gave of just, you did it very quickly and off the cuff, but I appreciated the way you explained your background in a particular way. And I think that that's very, very crucial to be able to explain one's background in a way that's relevant to the job they're applying to. And, you know, I was wondering, so you go from Columbia, you go the startup route, you join Plated, which, you know, at this point, Plated is a startup that's raised over $56 million in funding. They've been featured on Shark Tank. For those not familiar, they do home delivery of meals, 30-minute gourmet recipes and ingredients. They've been very successful. But I wonder, what were they like when you joined? Like, how big were they? And, like, when you walked in, what was that like?
It was really cool to watch. It really was. Like, I mean, everything that you think a startup is and like being part of those crazy early days, like that's exactly what it was. And that's why I really loved my time there. So, and I joined in June of 2014. They were barely 2 years old. And I was employee number 30, and we had 3 fulfillment centers. We had just opened a third in California. So barely 3 fulfillment centers, you know, we were doing a few thousand, orders a week. And it was very much like, you know, who can do this? Who can help? Like, can you figure something out on the operations team? And I think we were only 4 people at the time. So for the actual operations team, and it was very scrappy. You know, I was at the warehouse packing boxes. Like, we had pipes freeze one time in our warehouse in the Bronx. We had to send everybody home because there weren't any working bathrooms. And the headquarters staff was like, you know, screw it, we'll stay. We got to get these orders out. We'll go to the bathroom down the street. And so we were bundled up in the warehouse, packing boxes, trying to, you know, meet the shipment cutoff. So those early days were very chaotic and very much just like, let's keep up. We just got to keep up. And at the same time, we were trying to think long-term and put structures in place and strategy. But a lot of it was very much day-to-day, very tactical, very like, you know, in the trenches type stuff, which I really enjoyed because I learned a lot.
And they were 30 employees when you started. When you left, about how big were they?
I think they were about 120 in the headquarters. And so I didn't even know everybody. I was like, who are you? Like, when did you start? And we had 4 fulfillment centers. And, you know, we were probably doing about 10 times as many orders as we were before. And it was just incredible to see that. They built out the operations team. We probably doubled in size. So we were 9 or 10 people when I left, and then the headquarters, yeah, it was like around 120.
It's just crazy. And I like what you were saying about how veterans are well suited for a startup, in that you were essentially part of 5 different companies, like at mm-hmm. 30 people, you know, probably 50 and 75. It's just, I imagine that what was requested of you and needed from you changed so frequently, and the skill set and just, I mean, everything about your job and the company was constantly in flux. And I imagine that, you know, your background and most veterans makes them well adapted for like rapid change and being able to very quickly respond and just fill in holes wherever necessary.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And like, I'll tell that to anyone who listens. Like, I think that startups, both sides, employers and vets, like, I think that that is a perfect match. Because if you think about what they ask you to do as a junior officer, you know, I was a truck platoon commander. You know, we went out. They literally dropped me in Iraq and were like, go run convoys. And I was like, well, okay, I got to figure this out. You know, anyone that can do that, anyone that's had those junior positions, either on the officer or enlisted side, can absolutely, you know, do what it takes to get something done and you know, quickly analyze the situation, make the best decision you can with 80% of the information or maybe less than that. And so that's why I think it's just like an incredible fit. Mm. Honestly. Yeah.
No, I think that's the best description of a startup environment and why veterans are well suited for it. And so for someone on active duty listening, how would you describe your role as director of operations and logistics? Like, what did the day-to-day life look like? What sort of things were you doing in addition to like filling in and packing boxes and making things work?
Those boxes are heavy. That was a good workout. I, on a day-to-day basis, like, well, it changed a bit, you know, over the 2 years. So the first year or so, I would say it was really just about like figuring out what we were doing. Like, let's get a spreadsheet and figure out how much stuff costs. Let's start tracking things. Let's like put some systems in place. So it was really just like getting a handle on the status quo. So there was a lot of data work and a lot of tracking and evaluating and trying to figure out, you know, what we were doing and what it was costing us. And then the second year, like as the team grew a little bit and we had to start focusing more on scalability, it was more about strategy. So for example, like let's work on a project to figure out where our next fulfillment center will be and what will that do to our costs and to our delivery reach and to the number of options we can provide to the customer, et cetera. So The second year I was in a lot more meetings and doing a lot more PowerPoints and running models, et cetera, and working cross-functionally, because we were basically playing catch up for the first year, just trying to keep up with the volume that Shark Tank and the publicity had pushed on us. And then the second year I was there, so 2015 and 2016, was more about how do we scale this business and take it to the next level. And to do that, you had to have a lot more structure and systems in place. So we had a lot of cross-functional projects going on. Like, we launched a cookbook, we did a cross-country marketing tour, we tested some innovative delivery options, trying to get things to people faster and seeing what moves the needle and what would improve sales, et cetera. So a lot more strategic focused in the second half of my time there.
And startups have a reputation, I think, in pop culture of just being a 24/7, always on, like, exhilarating ride. Having worked now in two different startups, what would you say on average was your work schedule? Was it working on weekends? Was it working 12 hours a day, 8 hours a day? Just to give people a sense about the lifestyle component of startups.
So I'll qualify this by saying this is probably specific to operations type roles. Other people at company had different schedules, but for us, because we actually have a physical product and we were shipping, at the beginning it was just 2 or 3 days a week. We were up to shipping 6 to 8 towards the end. Something's always happening at the warehouse, which means the headquarters has to be turned on. I would wake up in the morning, like 6:30, 7 o'clock, whatever, check my email first thing. There was always a fire of some sort. So, on emails for the first couple hours, I was in the office probably 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. or 7 p.m. and on emails available after that. There's always something that was happening, and we felt, that it was our responsibility to support the SEs, the fulfillment centers. And we were online on weekends too, just because there was operations happening. I think the rest of my company was more of like a 10 to 6 Monday through Friday, with the exception of the engineers, the guys doing the coding, because if something operations breaks, there could be something engineering tied to it. They had to jump on and help us out. But it was very all-encompassing, which I personally like, and I was invested in it, and I wanted the team to be successful, so I didn't mind it.
That's great. And I guess looking back at your first couple years working out of the military, in what ways did you feel ahead of your civilian counterparts, and in what ways did you feel like you had to work to catch up?
I think I felt ahead, and this is an obvious answer, but like in terms of leadership and management, it was surprising to me to find out how many of my peers had never directly managed somebody, let alone a team of 35 people or more. And so I felt like I had a little bit more proficiency in that area, not only in terms of like managing my direct reports, but also knowing what a good management style was, like looking around at the leadership, at my companies, and being able to evaluate that, because I had a lot of, seen a lot of good leadership and a lot of bad leadership up close and personal. So I definitely felt like I had a little bit more experience in that area. In terms of where I had to catch up, I would say specifically for me, like in the finance area, and also dealing with engineers, like a tech company, it doesn't have to be a tech company, but any company these days is supported by a development team, engineers working to, like, whether it's build the website or build tools, et cetera. And so knowing the terminology to be able to work with those people, clearly communicate what it is that you need from them and how they can help you was something I had to learn. And same thing with the finance, like, what's a P&L? Like, how do we provide the correct inputs? How do we forecast? Because forecasting is a huge part of any business. And so learning the terminology and learning how to work with those teams, that was definitely a catch up for me. But luckily, both the companies I've worked at so far have been small enough that I can get close to those teams and kind of, learn what I didn't know before.
And for someone who's listening who might be interested in startups, and maybe they're on active duty and they're saying, maybe this is the right thing for me, what are some signs that they might really enjoy life in an early stage startup? And what are some signs that it might actually just drive them crazy?
I think the kinds of people that are drawn to this are people that like, you know, being autonomous. So do you like, you know, setting your own schedule, setting your own objectives, measuring your own performance, and then changing direction the next week? Do you like those things? I think if you're comfortable with a lack of structure, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. It just basically means that things are fluid and they can change, right? If you're okay with a lack of structure, and if that actually is better for you, then I think that a startup would be a good fit. Also, if one of the things that's most important to you is having a hand in direct execution, like being directly responsible for something. So like for me, at Playdit, like I wasn't responsible for the entire P&L, obviously, but I was responsible for two big inputs, the shipping costs and the packaging costs, which, you know, are a huge part of the operational cost structure. Like that to me motivated me. Like I wanted to see those numbers and that bottom line. So if you're a person that likes, you know, having a direct hand in the execution and a direct impact from the bottom line, then startup would be good for you. I think on the other hand, if a lack of structure scares you, if you're not okay with a little bit of risk in terms of the future of the company, because all these startups will sell you on their vision, right? They've got these great growth charts and strategies and plans and maps and et cetera. And their job is to sell investors on that. But that doesn't always materialize, or those fluctuations. If that kind of thing scares you, then I would think, you know, either looking at a larger, more stable company, or maybe a startup that's very well established and isn't going to have any cash flow problems. But yeah, the structure and ambiguity things are really the two. Like if you like it, it could be a good fit. If it scares you, then maybe you want to work for a larger company that has a little bit more certainty.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I often think of the ambiguity component in terms of, like you had spoken to earlier, of having 80% or less information and making decisions.
But usually less.
Yeah, usually less, far less. But the unpredictable, is that even a word? Unpredictableness of sure. You know, are we going to be in business in 6 months? Will I have a job in 6 months? Is this going to go under? Is this going to work? And I think your experience in Playdit is the best case example, where you're just on a rocket ship and just riding that thing high and just realizing, you know, in that world, that is really not as common. And so that comfort, especially I think from people coming from the job security of the military, of realizing like, oh, do you have the appetite to know that you may be looking for another job and having to explain what your company did because it doesn't exist anymore at your next employer. Right. But I think if someone has that tolerance for that, it can be such an incredible way to learn and just an incredible lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think something else that people need to evaluate is, you know, the compensation. Like realistically, the majority of startups are not going to pay you what you could get at a bank or a consulting firm. And it's a trade-off, right? Like you said, it could be a rocket ship. There's definitely equity that's involved. And that's something that, you know, I knew nothing about when I came out of the military. I had to kind of learn about what the value of that was to me in my particular situation. But, you know, a realistic point of view is that a startup is not going to pay that well, but what you're getting is hands-on in the trenches experience, like building a business, building something that hopefully you believe in. And then obviously there's an equity upside, but it's all potential maybe. And it's in the future. It's a long-term, like that shouldn't be counted on because you never know what's going to happen.
And no obligation to answer this, but I'm aware of how it seems like a lot of people on active duty sometimes have false expectations about their earning potential immediately out of the military. And I'm wondering, I mean, you went for 2 years deferring your salary and paying money to attend school, and then you jumped into a startup. When you first started at the startup, how did your salary compare to your military? Was it about the same or less or more than that?
You know, what's funny is sometimes I forget what I made in the military. It wasn't actually that long ago, but it was actually pretty close to the same, but I'm living in New York City, you know? So in terms of cost of living, once you factor that in, I was definitely making less than I was before. Yep. So it was pretty close, but you know, the math just didn't work out in New York. And another thing that was a new experience for me was like having to negotiate a salary, and Plated was doing very well. There was like lots of growth, but they had to guard their cash, you know, because they have to be judicious with how much they give out in salary, et cetera. So basically what I did was I took a trade off between salary and equity, and we tied some compensation bumps to future sales increases. And so I kind of buckled down for the first 6 months and waited for that growth to happen. And like, so it was tough for the first 6 months, but then things got a little better. And, but yeah, I think, the MBA gave me a little bit more bargaining power. I could say, hey, you know, like I've got this degree, I bought into this, like I have student loans, et cetera. So I think I was able to push a little higher. So my salary was pretty much on par, but for most of my friends that went into finance or consulting, they were making a lot more than they were when they got off active duty.
But the like you said, that trade-off with the equity where, you know, it could be worth considerably more or it could be worth nothing, and just kind of that's probably a good indication too, is if you have that risk tolerance to have a lot of the economic value or the financial value be very, very out of your control, mm-hmm. might be a good indication of whether startup life would be appealing.
Yeah, and I would encourage people to actually do the math on, you know, if a company is offering you a position with whatever salary and whatever, you know, number of equity options, do the math. Like, what's the max those options could actually be worth? And then take out taxes. That takes away half of it. And ask yourself, like, what's the probability of this actually happening, number one? And number two, is this a life-changing amount of money? And the answer to both of those is it's probably a low probability, and it's probably not a life-changing amount of money. And so I think people tend to overvalue equity just because, you know, they see, like you said, in pop culture, like this, like huge explosions, unicorns, et cetera. But the average startup, even if it's a successful business, is not going to give you tens of millions of dollars in equity 3 or 4 years on the line. It's just not going to happen. So
it's even more appalling for me is that the number of people that I've hired at Storybox and the number of people who, you know, in the offer letter, it generally says the number of shares, which mm-hmm. doesn't tell you the number of total shares. So you have like the you have the numerator but not the mm-hmm. denominator. And so a lot of people will see 40,000 shares and think, oh, that's really good, but they're missing the critical information of like, is that 10% of the company or 0.01%? And right. I just echo
and
what
at
you're
what
saying.
Valuation.
Yeah. And so I like that thought, and there's probably some great resources online, but of doing that math and then just really having some sense of what the real value is of that.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Well, let's talk about Crave Crush. And it sounds like you are on the front line of the war on sugar. But how would you explain Crave Crush and what you guys are doing?
Yeah, so Crave Crush it's a four-person company at the moment. It's a health and wellness company. We're based in New York City. And we have developed and are bringing to market a dietary supplement called Crave Crush. And what Crave Crush does is it dissolves in your tongue and it binds to your sugar receptors. So when you eat something sweet, it's blocked. You won't taste the sweet. And so what that's doing is it's interrupting the reward cycle. So you eat something sweet, your sugar receptors get it, and then you get a reward signal in your brain, which actually makes you want to eat more. So what this product is trying to do is interrupt that cycle so you can curb cravings in the moment and then in the long term break habits of sugar dependency.
That's incredible. I think it's worthwhile too for people's health and well-being. And I'm just wondering, so you are running towards, you got a taste of startup life and you took on even more risks. So you went from 30 people to now 4 people. I'm wondering what led to that transition and how did you find Crave Crush? Like, what was that process like?
So, you know, I had a great time at Plated. I learned a ton. I'm so thankful for that opportunity. But at a certain point, like it got a little too big for me, I think. I still feel a little bit like I left some stuff on the table, where there were some really great things happening and lots of growth, et cetera. But what I enjoyed most was the time when I started, when I was, like I said, doing the tactical day-to-day stuff in the trenches and building something. And there was still that opportunity at Plated, but I wanted more of it. And so I wanted to go to a company that allowed me to kind of go backwards, which is not normally what people do in their careers. They want to go forward, right? But I wanted to go backward in terms of like the stage of the company and the size of the company. So, you know, here's a plug for Columbia Business School. went got my MBA there and was in a class with another woman named Ariane, who became a friend of mine. And she joined this company, Crave Crush, right after school and has been working for the past 2 years on the formulation, like doing the hard work, doing the science. Like, how do we, you know, on the molecular level, like, what is this stuff and how do we manipulate it to make it effective and how do we manufacture it and refine it, et cetera. So she's been working on this for 2 years. And she kind of knew that I was looking around when I was at Plated, and she took me to dinner and basically made me an offer I couldn't refuse. So she told me she was basically going to let me set up the operations and the supply chain for the company. And the long and short of it is I was looking for something that was a little bit earlier stage, and like an absolute requirement for me was a product that I believed in. And I think we have a big problem in this country with the sugar in literally everything, the modern food supply chain and diabetes and obesity, et cetera. So I saw this as a way to kind of get involved with a product that I think can be very successful and that can also positively impact people. So that was, it was kind of a no-brainer for me.
I'm just thinking, and I can hear it in your voice talking about it, but as someone in operations, being able to just have ownership of such a major part of a company must be so exhilarating, and being able to build up everything just the way you want it. And just, I can imagine on one hand how much work that would be and how intimidating that would be. And I can imagine how rewarding and creative and how energizing that would be. And I'm just wondering, for people listening, I think operations is a common thing that veterans are well suited for. And I'm wondering how you how much you think about like your career in the next 5 years or 10 years. Like, do you think about where you want to end up in operations, or is it more about just finding the next experience and getting the most value and then learning from that and seeing where your tastes take you?
I mean, I probably should be thinking a little bit more about the first one you mentioned, like, where do I want to go and what do I want this to be? I think in the long term, what I would love to do is be involved, you know, work for a VC. So a company that invests in other companies. And I think having worked in operations at startups, like literally being in the trenches, would give me a really great perspective and be able to help me give really good advice and, you know, be valuable to that, you know, venture capital firm. But I don't think too much about it, honestly. Like, I've had some friends weigh in, some friends and family weigh in saying, hey, like, you know, what is the concrete path that you're taking? And I really can't answer it, but I'm okay with that. And maybe that's part of the reason why I'm in startups. I will say that I think that there's value in working for a company that's established and successful and has institutional knowledge. And if I had it to do over again, I might consider doing that for a year or two out of school, just to see how things should run, how a successful company does things. And you can kind of take that, add it to your toolkit, and then go build something with the knowledge of how a successful company has done something. I think there's certainly value in that. I don't regret my path at all, but that's something like I would offer to others who are considering that path. You know, I think I could personally probably have added more value at the startups that I've been at if I had been a part of a larger organization for a year or two.
Yeah, I think you and I are very similar. I feel like that in many ways of learning a skill set from a well-established company is a significant mm-hmm. advantage that I never really was able to benefit from. And I also relate to that thought of like, I maybe it's my personality or just startups, but the thought of approaching this as where I'm going to be in 5 years, it just seems like things change so rapidly that it's an exercise in futility to try and predict where things will go. And as mm-hmm. you learn and are exposed to more things and desire more of what figure out more of what you want. And I was going to say, I could, you know, just given your experience and that you like that really early stage of operations, I could see how, you know, if you did follow that path to venture capital and you were working amongst their portfolio companies and diving into these early stages and providing knowledge from your experience in a couple different companies about how to set up their operations and how to think about that, I could see how valuable that would be to the venture capital firm, but also to the startups, and how rewarding that would be for you. And so that seems like a very realistic mm-hmm. path.
I hope so. I mean, everything, it feels like a lot of what we do at my current startup and at Plated is reinvent the wheel, because, you know, a lot of people aren't willing to tell you exactly how they did something because they want to protect what they've built and what they're doing. And there is a lot of dialogue between entrepreneurs and people that work at startups, but a lot of it, you just have to kind of figure out for yourself. So like, if I can add some value to other companies that are going through something I've already been through, then I think that's probably a value add. So hopefully it's a fit somewhere in the long term.
That's great. Well, you've given a ton of value for me and for the listeners. I wanted to just open it up as well. If there was anything else, you know, having a veteran audience listening, anything else that I didn't talk about or that you wanted to share or advice or just something you would throw out, I'm open to whatever you'd want to share.
Something I learned probably a little bit too late is that you really need to sit down and write out what you want from a career. Like, what's important to you? Where do you want to live? How much money do you need to make? What kinds of things do you like doing? What are non-negotiables for you? And kind of shape your career search in that way. I think my mistake was coming into school and not having done that, and then getting caught up in this recruiting process that really put me on a path that I was not passionate about, but that I thought would be, you know, I thought it was a good idea because everyone else thought it was a good idea. So I think if I'd done that exercise earlier, and if I'd actually forced myself to sit down and take a hard look at like what my priorities were and what got me excited and what I could potentially do for work and not, you know, want to kill myself every day, I think I would have probably gotten to where I ended up a lot quicker with a lot less pain. But I think a lot of people just feel pressure to jump into something. They want a job, they want the certainty of that, and they skip that exercise, and it really just ends up causing more work on the back end.
And I'm reminded as you say that of how valuable that is, not just at that initial transition, but every couple of years as each person changes and grows and redefines what they want or don't want, just that value mm-hmm. of just really being deliberate in articulating what exactly you want. Because it is so easy mm-hmm. to get caught up in chasing what other people are chasing or going after something just, you know, losing sight of why you're even going after it. So I think that's really, really solid mm-hmm. advice.
I do have one more saved round.
Yeah.
So I will say that, like, I mean, I think everybody could agree that the military does not do a good job of helping you transition. And there, once you're out, I mean, you're pretty much out. Like, there's no career help, you know, from the Marine Corps, for example, once you get out. So for anyone that's listening that's still active duty, just remember that you have a responsibility. Like, if you're in a leadership position, whether it's a fire team leader or a company commander, whatever it is, you have a responsibility to set your people up for success. So whether you're going through this transition now or if you're planning it later, like, I think that the leadership of the military has a responsibility. You know, make sure everybody's got a LinkedIn profile. Help them get someone to review their resume. Like, talk to them about school options, et cetera. Like, we owe it to people, and there just really isn't a great organization that's set up to help people. And so the people who are in active duty, you know, need to set everyone up for success.
Yeah, I think that's great. No, I completely agree. And I think I love that thought of, taking advantage of while you're on active duty to help out those around you in preparing, setting them up for success in their future career. So, Katie, thank you so much for your time. Katie's at cravecrush.com. Go to their site, sign up to learn about their launch. They will email you when they launch with more information. Thank you so much, Katie. I really appreciate it.
Surface.
Thanks for listening. Three quick announcements. First, if you're enjoying this podcast, it would mean a lot if you take a few minutes to leave a review on iTunes. It helps me get this work further out to the veteran community. Second, based on my interviews, I'd advise any and all veterans to look at servicetoschool.org and the American Corporate Partners. Both are completely free for veterans and give you a lot of great resources for your education or professional life, respectively. Third, there are a ton of other great interviews, resources, and data at beyondtheuniform.io. Check it out, share it with your friends, and drop me a line if you have any feedback. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks, and see you on the next interview.